times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. The typical American diet today includes much more added sugar than a generation or two ago, largely because of processed foods. U.S. adults get about 15% of their daily calories from those added sugars. That has enormous health consequences, according to our guest, Dr. Robert Lustig. He's director of the Weight Assessment for Teen and Child Health Program at the University of California in San Francisco, and he has spent the last 20 years studying the effects of sugar on the central nervous system and metabolism. He's also the author of Fat Chance and a new book called The Fat Chance Cookbook. And Robert Lustig, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me again, Marty. Appreciate it.
Track, if you could, for our listeners, just how much added sugar has been added to our diet over the last generation or two. When did we see the start of this?
Well, actually, if you have to go back quite a ways to really understand this. Let's go back 200 years to 1820 to start with. We used to consume about 4 pounds of sugar per year, and that came mostly as fruits, vegetables, and the occasional honey. With the advent of the sugar-producing industry here in the United States, in Louisiana and Hawaii, we saw a real increase in that over the late 1800s. And at around 1930, we stabilized. And at that point in time, we were consuming, instead of 4 pounds a year, we were consuming about, and this is a guesstimate,
sure,
about 50 to 55 pounds per year. Then we hit World War II, and then we reduced our consumption during World War II with rationing. And then that went back up again to about that same 55 to 60 pounds per year. And it stayed there until the late 1970s with the advent of high fructose corn syrup. And that really took off. We ended up increasing our sugar consumption at that point to where we finally reached about 120 pounds per year by the year 2000. Now, we have since, because of the obesity epidemic, because of the diabetes epidemic, because of the cardiovascular disease epidemic, we have actually reduced our consumption since that time by about 8%. So people say, oh, you know, it's gone down over the last decade. And indeed it has, as we've substituted diet sodas, which have their own questionable significance in this whole issue. But the fact is, we are still consuming about 1,000% more than our ancestors did. And that therein lies the rub. That's the problem. The amount is just overwhelming our ability to be able to metabolize it.
And is that amount of sugar, is that in part what describes the obesity epidemic, the fact that we're eating so much more sugar? Is that why we're so fat?
Well, let's be very honest. The studies on sugar and weight gain definitely show an effect. There's no question that sugar has an effect on weight gain. But when you do the math, it's only worth about 0.8 BMI points. That's about 10% of our problem. So does sugar cause weight gain? Yes. Is sugar a cause of obesity? In some, likely. Is sugar the cause of obesity? Not even close. In fact, my colleague, Dr. Darius Mozafarian, who I will be having dinner with tonight, he's at Harvard School of Public Health. He's here in San Francisco for the American Heart Association meeting. Published a paper several years ago in the New England Journal showing that the number one and number two items in terms of weight gain are potato chips and French fries. Sugar comes in a distant third, and I agree with that. The fact is, there are a lot of things that contribute calories and that contribute weight gain. It's a weight gain. What I am saying is that the obesity issue and the chronic metabolic disease issue, the diabetes issue, the heart disease issue, can be dissociated, because normal weight people get these diseases as well. In fact, 80% of obese people are sick. That means 20% of obese people are not. They're healthy. They're metabolically healthy. They will die at a normal age, not cost the taxpayer a dime. They're just fat. Conversely, 40% of the normal weight population have the same metabolic diseases as do the obese. they get the same diseases. They get type 2 diabetes. They get hypertension. They get lipid problems. They get heart disease. They get cancer. They get dementia, all of which are chronic metabolic diseases. And they think they're okay because they're normal weight. Well, they're not. And the problem is that the reason they get those chronic metabolic diseases is the same reason that the obese get them. Sugar.
Let me pick up on that, because there is sugar, as you say, and then there is sugar. Because you are not opposed to the kind of sugar that we eat in an apple or in fruits. The culprit, from your perspective, is this high fructose corn syrup that's added to just about all the processed foods that we eat.
No, not quite.
No?
Let me try
okay.
to clarify this for
okay.
you. I am not against apples. I am not against any fruit. And the reason is because fruit comes with its inherent fiber. Fiber mitigates the negative effects of the fructose, this bad molecule in sugar, the sweet molecule in sugar. Sadly, the sweet molecule is the bad molecule, and there are reasons why that's true. But the fact is that the fiber makes it so that that sugar in that apple, in that pear, in that peach is not going to do damage. And the reason is because the fiber reduces the rate of absorption so that your liver has a chance to catch up. Also, the fiber will deliver more of the nutrients further down the intestine so that the bacteria will get them instead of you. You have to feed your bacteria. Each of us is 10 trillion cells, but we have 100 trillion bacteria in our intestine. They have to eat something. The question is, what do they eat? Well, they eat what you eat. The question is, how much did you get versus how much did they get? And when you're talking about chronic metabolic disease, you want your bacteria to get more. So fiber helps you do that. So fiber in fruit is not the problem. It's the refined sugar. And there are two forms. There's sucrose, the table sugar, the cane sugar, the beet sugar. And that's what the rest of the world uses. And they have the same problems we do. And then here in the United States, of course, we have high fructose corn syrup.
Right.
So sucrose, high fructose corn syrup, agave, maple syrup, honey, calorie for calorie, ounce for ounce, gram for gram, equally bad for you. So it's not just HFCS. The reason HFCS is such a problem is not because it's worse metabolically. The reason it's such a problem is because it's cheap.
And there's so much of it.
It's cheap. Because it's cheap, there's so much of it.
Well, I know from having interviewed you a couple of years ago and also looking through your books as well, when we talk about fructose, it's really how the liver metabolizes the fructose, and that's part of where some of these chronic diseases come from.
Exactly. The point is that the standard mantra around, you know, the country still, even from medical circles, is a calorie is a calorie. You know, Coca-Cola said it straight out last year in their Coming Together video, you know, that tried to absolve them of any blame for the obesity epidemic. And they very specifically state, and this is a direct quote from that video, beating obesity will take action by all of us based on one simple common sense fact. All calories count, no matter where they come from, including Coca-Cola and everything else with calories. That's a direct quote. So they don't care if, you know, they're saying the calories can come from, you know, carrots, the calories can come from cheesecake, calories can come from Coca-Cola, or anything else with a C for that matter. It doesn't matter where the calories come from, a calorie is a calorie. And if we, human beings, were bomb calorimeters, that is, you threw the food in, you blew it up, and you recouped the energy that blowing the food up, you know, got you, then they would be right. A calorie would be a calorie. But we are not bomb calorimeters. We have exquisite biochemical systems in our bodies that metabolize different calories along different pathways, leading to different end products and causing different diseases. And when you understand that, you understand that there are certain calories that are better for you than others. There are certain calories that are actually, believe it or not, toxic.
Well,
and I can prove it.
Well,
let's just take one calorie. Let me finish the thought.
Okay, go ahead.
Let's take alcohol.
Sure.
Okay, alcohol are calories, you know, but alcohol is toxic. And alcohol is not toxic because of the calories. It has nothing to do with the alcohol's effects on obesity. Alcohol is toxic because alcohol is alcohol. Well, sugar does the exact same things alcohol does. And sugar is the thing that's going up in our diet.
Well, let me just pick up on that. Taking a person and a body and all their organs, So their body is differentiating between them eating a chocolate cake, them eating a piece of steak, them eating tofu, them eating a bowl of pasta.
Correct. Every one of those does something different inside the body. Every one of those is handled differently by the intestine, by the liver, by the other organs in the body. Every one of those has a specific metabolic signature that we can now follow and determine exactly what happened to that food and what sequelae though that specific food ended up causing. And that is exactly what has been done around the country, not just by us, but by many investigators, to show that there are specific foodstuffs that are handled differently by the mitochondria in your cells. These are the energy-burning factories inside your cells. And I can name the four that all have the same metabolic signature. Trans fats, but we know those are bad and they're going down. Branched chain amino acids, leucine, isoleucine, valine, which you get from corn-fed beef, chicken, and fish. Alcohol and fructose. Well, kids don't drink alcohol, and their branched chain amino acids are for the most part fixed. And trans fats are coming down. Mm. What isn't coming down? Sugar.
You're saying it's the sugar. But using the alcohol example, I mean, some people cannot handle alcohol and should not drink it, and many of them do not drink it. But for most of the population, you know, we can handle a drink here or there. Using that as an example for sugar, are you just saying we just have to moderate our intake, our input of sugar?
Right. Well, here's the problem. Alcohol is supposed to be a pleasure, a reward, a celebratory event. Okay? The question is, if it's a celebratory event, why are you celebrating every day? This is the problem. The problem is not one drink. The problem is many drinks and many drinks per day. Same thing with sugar. Sugar used to be a condiment. Sugar used to be celebratory. Sugar, dessert used to be once a week. Well, unfortunately now, dessert is once a meal. And that is where the problem is. Mm. And the problem is not one dessert. The problem is 10,000. And that's what we've got right now. Let's just take the National School Breakfast Program as an example. 25% of American kids are getting their breakfast in the National School Breakfast Program. What does it consist of? It consists of a bowl of Fruit Loops and a glass of orange juice. That's 11 teaspoons of added sugar per day. The American Heart Association says 4 teaspoons of added sugar per day is the limit for kids. That is almost triple, and it's just breakfast.
Well, you know what?
That's the problem.
Hold on to that thought only because we have to take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. We are talking in this hour of Radio Times about sugar, and our guest is Dr. Robert Lustig, director of the Weight Assessment and Teen Child Health Program. That's at the University of California in San Francisco. He has been studying the effects of sugar on the central nervous system, on metabolism. He's also been writing about sugar. He's got a book called Fat Chance and the Fat Chance Cookbook. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Simpson Meadows, a retirement community in Downingtown, PA, in Chester County. Managed by Simpson Senior Services, a nonprofit with a long-standing tradition of care. Simpson Meadows provides personal care for senior adults, along with memory care, respite, and independent living. A specially designed personal care neighborhood staffed with licensed nurses provides assistance with daily tasks to help residents remain as independent as possible. More at SimpsonMeadows.org.
The world moves quickly.
And information is bombarding us from all directions. TV, newspapers, the internet.
You need Morning Edition, NPR's weekday news magazine, to slow down that news.
To help you make sense of it.
Not by accepting the quick, easy answer.
But by asking more questions, digging deeper.
Helping you to understand the story behind the headlines.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News.
Weekday mornings on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, the Prince Music Theater, presenting Mark Nadler in I'm a Stranger Here Myself, April 2nd through 12th at the Prince Music Theater. I'm a Stranger Here Myself recreates the underground world of German cabarets that flourished as Hitler rose to power. In this hidden community, creativity flourished as Jews and gay people used funny, daring, and divinely decadent songs to proclaim their identity and their resistance in the face of terror. Tickets and information at PrinceMusicTheater.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking with physician Robert Lustig about sugar, diet, food, and health. And we have a lot of calls, people that want to join our conversation. I want to pick up on something you said about dessert. And I wonder whether it's more than just dessert. It's just that there is sugar or processed sugar, the bad sugar you've been talking about, in tomato sauce, in chips, in cookies, and so much. Well, cookies, I guess, would be some form of dessert. But that there's sugar in everything that doesn't seem to even sound like a dessert.
Exactly. Here's the problem. The American Heart Association came out with its recommendations in 2009. I helped write them, so I subscribe to them. That women should consume no more than 6 teaspoons of added sugar per day and men 9 teaspoons of added sugar per day. Now, that's a reduction by 2/3 to 3/4 from our current 22 teaspoons of added sugar per day. So that's a big, big number to try to get down. So the question is, where is the sugar in our diet? And the answer is 1/3 of it is in soft drinks. 1/6 of it is in things we would identify as dessert, like candy and cookies and ice cream. That means that fully 1/2 of the added sugar in our diet is in things we didn't know had it,
right,
like tomato sauce, ketchup, yogurt, hamburger buns, hamburger meat for that matter. The point is that hidden sugar is put there very specifically by the food industry to get you to buy more. And sadly, it's extraordinarily effective at doing so. So if you got rid of all the sodas, and you got rid of all of the candy and ice cream, you'd still be over your limit, and that's a problem. That means that we need a wholesale reformulation of our food supply in order to get healthy. And, of course, the food industry is fighting this tooth and nail.
But would we have to change our taste buds? I mean, let's be honest, sugar tastes good.
Well, it does. Well, the point is that you can desensitize your taste buds to sugar such that things that are minimally sweet all of a sudden taste maximally sweet. It takes about 3 to 4 weeks of, you know, sort of going sugar-free in order to be able to do this. My patients in my clinic do this routinely. This is, you know, what we end up having to do for them. My suggestion and the suggestion of the Group Action on Sugar in the United Kingdom, which I'm a member of, says that what needs to happen is that government and the industry need to get together and reduce sugar content in various foodstuffs across the board by weaning it over time. They did this with salt in the UK several years ago and was very successful, and they didn't even tell the populace that they were doing it.
Hmm.
Now, here in the United States, the Institute of Medicine and the FDA said that we needed to do that back in 2010, and guess what? Here we are in 2014, and nothing's been done, again, because the food industry has fought it tooth and nail. Bottom line, if you let the food industry run our food supply, you're going to get continued problems with metabolic disease.
How, though, do you factor in, if we're talking about a health issue, even factor in things like portion sizes? You mentioned soft drinks. I mean, you go to the movies and order a small soft drink, and you need two hands to hold it. As we know, I mean,
well,
portions are just enormous in this country. Well, I'm sorry.
Right.
Go ahead.
That's what Bloomberg tried to fix.
Yes,
you know?
He did.
I mean, that was the whole idea behind the Bloomberg Big Gulp ban. You know, who needs a 32-ounce soda? Well, nobody needs a 32-ounce soda. In fact, nobody needs a 4-ounce soda. You know, there's no need for it. There's no biochemical reaction in the body that requires dietary fructose. In fact, there's nothing in a can of soda you need. Oh, I mean, there are things in a can of soda you like.
Sure.
I'm not arguing that. And I'm not suggesting that soda be banned, but the fact is nobody needs any of it. So why do we have such large volumes of it? It's very simple. Because it costs 2 cents to produce, and they sell it for a dollar. That's the reason. The profit margin on a can of soda is so enormous that it only pays for them to put out more and more, get you more and more hooked so that you'll consume more and more. The problem is, now we're getting sick from it.
I do want to get to our callers, but I'm curious about the possible risks of focusing so much on sugar when there are so many other parts of our diet that probably cause some of the diseases that you have been researching and treating and looking at, whether it's fat or whether it's portion size and all these things.
Oh, I couldn't agree more, Marty. I'll be very honest with you. The media has painted me as the anti-sugar guy. This is not true. I am the anti-processed food guy. There are actually 8 things wrong with our diet. 3 things too little and 5 things too much. Let me list them for you so that the audience gets the picture and, you know, doesn't, you know, sort of lambaste me for, you know, just being concerned about one nutrient. I'm not. I'm concerned about 8 nutrients. I'm concerned about 8 things. Too little fiber. Too little micronutrients. Too little omega-3 fatty acids. Too much alcohol. Too much branched-chain amino acids, too much omega-6 fatty acids, too much trans fats, and finally, too much sugar. But of those 8, sugar is the one that the food industry specifically puts in to get you to buy more. Sugar is the one that's actionable today, as opposed to the others, which would be much harder to deal with. But there's an easy way to deal with all 8 all at once, and it's called real food.
Mm.
So I'm the real food guy. I'm not the anti-sugar guy. I'm the anti-processed food guy. And, I know that later on in the show, Dr. Frank Hu will be on the call as well. And, you know, he knows my stance on this. And, I'm sure we will be able to all agree on real food as the answer to pretty much all of, the nutritional ills that befall us today.
Indeed. Let me just quickly reintroduce you, and I do want to get some callers in and some emails and tweets as well. And again, that's Dr. Robert Lustig, Director of the Weight Assessment for Teen and Child Health Program. That's at the University of California in San Francisco. And he's also the author of Fat Chance, Beating the Odds Against Sugar, Processed Food, Obesity, and Disease, and a new one called the Fat Chance Cookbook. And let me get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. We have Dan, and Dan is joining us from Malvern. Hi, Dan. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Couple questions. Why did the human body evolve to sense sugar? And second, is there any good studies showing that unrefined sugars in their natural complex states with other minerals are handled okay by the body? And third, why do certain alcohols and other chemicals be sensed as sugar, such as xylitol, mannitol, sorbitol, and are they safe to use as replacements? And then stevia, which is, I don't know what kind of class that is, but it's like 400 times sweeter, the sensation, but with no calories.
Well, Dan, let me see if we can answer at least some of those questions. Let me put the first one to you, Robert Lustig.
Yes.
The others I didn't necessarily understand, but why do we like sugar so much?
I wish I knew. we really do like it.
We do.
We don't know for sure why we like it so much, but we do. And I can prove we do. If you have children, when they were infants, how many times did you have to introduce a savory food to an infant before you would get them to accept it? Answer, 13 times on average. That's what the studies show,
right.
13 times.
Right.
But how many times do you have to introduce a sweet food before you get them to accept it?
Just once.
Right. We are programmed to like this stuff. Okay, it's in our DNA, and I can't tell you exactly why, but we have a hypothesis, we have a theory as to why. Because there are no foodstuffs on the planet that are both sweet and acutely poisonous at the same time. Sugar, the sweet signal in food, was the signal to our ancestors that any given foodstuff was safe to eat, that it wouldn't make them keel over and die, that there were no poisons. As an example, Jamaican ackee fruit. When the ackee fruit is immature and on the vine, on the tree, before it has a chance to bloom and ultimately fall to the ground, there's a compound in it called hypoglycin. And if you consume immature ackee fruit, you get a disease called Jamaican vomiting sickness, and you can die from that. And you get hypoglycemic, and I actually, have seen a case of this.
Wow.
But if you wait till the fruit blooms and then it falls from the tree, the hypoglycin is metabolized, and now it's mildly sweet. And ackee fruit, of course, is the national foodstuff of Jamaica. Point is, our ancestors loved this stuff, knew that if they ate it acutely, it wouldn't kill them. We think that may be why we like it so much, but I can't be sure. But that's a Darwinian explanation.
That's a very interesting interesting one. And I guess a quick answer to the questions our guest had, that our caller had, that I did not understand.
Okay, so he asked about sugar alcohols and other diet sweeteners. And the short answer to that is we don't know. I wish we did. The fact is we don't know because the data don't exist. And I'll explain quickly why. So there's something called pharmacokinetics and there's something called pharmacodynamics. They are not the same. Pharmacokinetics is what a drug does to your body. Sorry, what your body does to a drug. And pharmacodynamics is what a drug does to your body. They are not the same. We have all the pharmacokinetics for all the diet sweeteners because the Food and Drug Administration demands it. Okay, because pharmacokinetics tells you about acute toxicity. It tells you whether you're going to keel over and die. And that's in the FDA's charter. They're supposed to do that. But pharmacodynamics is not in the FDA's charter. These are the long-term effects of various foodstuffs. The question of chronic toxicity. This is why tobacco was never banned by the FDA, even though there were calls for it to do so, because their job is not to monitor chronic toxicity. So the FDA does not demand these studies. And the food industry says, well, if the FDA doesn't demand it, and these are expensive studies that take a long time to do, and they can't help our sales, why should we do them? We're not going to do them. So we don't have the data. And then the NIH says, well, this is the food industry's compound. They're making money off it. It's their job. So they don't pay for it. So we got an FDA who doesn't require it, we got a food industry who won't do it, and we get an FDA who won't pay for it. No data.
Let me get Carrie from, looks like Swarthmore, to join our conversation. Hi, Carrie, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I have a question about sugar and addiction. I have one of my children who craves sugar so much that they'll, you know, steal Halloween candy and sneak it and that type of thing.
Yep.
And I worry about limiting it totally because I have a fear of eating disorders and that type of thing, but I don't quite know how to handle it. And I'm curious as to whether some people truly have cravings and addictions and then to that type of, to whatever sugar gives them. And can you, how do you control that? And there's also a history of diabetes in our family. So it is truthfully, I mean, it's a health concern.
I totally understand.
Yeah,
and I see many patients just like this in my clinic. Here's what I can tell you. In animals, we have the data that sugar is addictive, in rats. My colleague, Dr. Nicole Avena, has done all of these studies in animals, and there are certain criteria you have to meet to demonstrate that a substance is addictive, and sugar meets all of those criteria in animals. What about humans? So, we have the data for sugar-causing tolerance, and tolerance is a specific effect on dopamine receptors in the reward center of the brain, where more and more gives you less and less reward, finally to the point where you have to consume a lot to get almost no reward. And we have that for sure in humans. Withdrawal, on the other hand, is a little bit more complicated. And one of the reasons is because if you're addicted to sugar, the way you're getting it is you're mainlining it, and it's called a soda. And what else does soda have? Caffeine. So people who go off soda definitely get the jitters. They definitely get the headaches. And the question is that the caffeine withdrawal or the sugar withdrawal or both? And we actually don't know the answer to that yet. The data on sugar addiction in humans is coming in now. And so the addiction specialists are being very, very loath to actually, you know, put their moniker of addiction on it. My colleague, Dr. Laura Schmidt here at UCSF, says, don't bother with the word addiction. It's too inflammatory. It's too incendiary. Just say abused. Sugar is definitely abused, and everyone can get behind that. And so am I worried about this issue and what it, in terms of its driving consumption and chronic metabolic disease? Absolutely. So for your daughter, yes, trying to cut her off completely is going to be problematic. And, yes, I certainly do not want her, you know, to evoke an eating disorder because you've done that. There are, you know, reasons for, you know, cutting back on the, you know, foodstuffs that are within the house. You might have to take her money away from her so that she can't go to the convenience store on the way home from school. And you know that there's a convenience store within 500 feet of every school in America because kids are a target. and this is why. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you're going to have to do your best to try to limit availability in order to try to get her to understand. And when she's older, hopefully she will.
Carrie, good luck with that, and thanks for the call to Radio Times. Robert Lustig, let me go back to you, because one of the things that you have written is the goal, I guess the goal that all of us should think about is to keep our insulin low. Can you expand
right.
on that? Well, why that's sure. important and how that works?
Absolutely. So, you know, the big issue in weight gain is not the calories. The big issue in weight gain is the insulin. Now, insulin drives energy into fat. That's insulin's job. Insulin is the energy storage hormone. Whatever you don't burn, you store, and the way you get it there is with insulin. Insulin opens the door to the fat cell to let the energy in. So keeping your insulin down is a priority if you're trying to control your weight, and pretty much everybody is. In addition, hyperinsulinemia is associated with all of these diseases that we've talked about, all these chronic metabolic diseases. So keeping your insulin down is priority. This is, of course, where the concept of glycemic index came from. So glycemic index is how high does your blood sugar rise, which therefore is how high does your insulin rise, after 50 grams of a carbohydrate in a given food. And so this is where the low glycemic index diet sort of took off from. The idea to keep your insulin down by consuming foods that don't drive your blood sugar up. And I agree with that to a point. The problem with the glycemic index concept is fructose is low glycemic index because fructose does not raise your blood glucose. Fructose raises your blood fructose. And blood fructose is way more damaging than blood glucose ever was. So if you told me that you put somebody on a low glycemic index diet but allowed them to eat sugar because sugar was low glycemic index, I would tell you were full of crap. But if you told me you put them on a low glycemic index diet and a low sugar diet,
right,
which is what my colleague in Boston, Dr. David Ludwig at Boston Children's does, I would say that's terrific. No problem, because you're keeping your insulin down. And I'm totally for Dr. Ludwig, and you know, and we agree on this issue. The insulin is the bad guy in the story. The question is, what does a low glycemic index diet combined with a low sugar diet look like? What's it called? It's called real food.
Okay, fair enough. About a minute before our first break, let me just toss an email from Doug having to do with juices and orange juice. And I know you like fruit, but you don't like fruit juices. How come? In 45
Correct.
Seconds.
Very simple, because fruit juice doesn't have the fiber. So you need, there are two kinds of fiber. There's soluble fiber and insoluble fiber. Soluble fiber is like the pectins that hold jelly together, and insoluble fiber is the cellulose, the stringy stuff in celery. You need both. It acts like when you have the two together, it acts like a gel on the inside of your intestine, forms a secondary barrier that prevents the absorption early on in the intestine. That means that your liver is protected because the sugar gets absorbed slowly, and the bacteria get a more sizable proportion of it, both of which are good for you. So when you consume the fruit as it exists in nature with its inherent fiber, you win. But when you take the juice and you smoothie it, or you juice it and you throw the fiber in the garbage, now what you're doing is you're getting only the soluble fiber, not the insoluble fiber. The insoluble fiber ended up in the garbage. You're not getting the beneficial effects of the fiber on the fruit, and you might as well be drinking a soda.
We are talking about sugar and its effect on our health. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, the Walnut Street Theater, presenting Arsenic and Old Lace, Broadway's classic comedy. Mortimer Brewster is worried that his lovely fiancée won't understand his unusual family. Abby and Martha Brewster are known for their acts of kindness and charity, but Mortimer has learned that his charming spinster aunts have taken to relieving the loneliness of old men by inviting them in for a nice glass of elderberry wine, laced with arsenic and just a pinch of cyanide. March 11th through April 27th. Details at walnutstreettheater.org, Ticketmaster, or 215-574-3550.
On the next Fresh Air, a story of cannibalism and colonialism. Journalist Carl Hoffman investigates the disappearance of 23-year-old Michael Rockefeller from off the coast of New Guinea over 50 years ago while on an expedition to collect primitive art. Hoffman's new book is called Savage Harvest. Also, an interview with saxophonist and composer Marty Ehrlich. Join us.
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
It was a huge mess, you know, that old Big Bang. Is that mess still detectable? Is the gravitational energy that keeps us stuck to the Earth an echo from 4 billion years ago, give or take a trillionth of a second? Gravity's waves from the Big Bang's ripples. We'll explain everything next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and we are talking about sugar in this hour. And again, our guest, Robert Lustig, director of the Weight Assessment for Teen and Child Health Program at the University of California in San Francisco. And as predicted, we are also joined by Dr. Frank Hu. He's a professor of nutrition and epidemiology at the Harvard School of Public Health. And Dr. Hu, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's my pleasure.
Do we eat too much sugar? That's what I've been talking with Dr. Lustig about. Do we eat too much sugar?
There is no question about it. We just published a paper with colleagues at CDC. We found that the American diet is too sweet. On average, Americans consume about 15% calories from added sugar, which is equivalent to 22 teaspoons of sugar every day. That's a lot of sugar. Those are the sugars added to the food during processing, and this doesn't include naturally occurring sugars in fruits and vegetables and milk. Just give you some statistics,
sure.
I think, which may be surprising to a lot of people. One can of soda contains 9 to 10 teaspoons of sugar, which is about 140 to 150 calories. So this is just one can of soda. And one cup of yogurt can easily contain 5 to 6 teaspoons of sugar. And you may be surprised to know that one tablespoon of ketchup contains 1 teaspoon of sugar. So added sugar is everywhere. It's ubiquitous in our food supplies, and there is no question that American diet is too sweet, and this can actually cause bitter health consequences.
Well, I have to say, Robert Lustig, I'm assuming you're nodding your head as Frank, who is talking about added sugar.
Nice to talk with you again. Robert, good talk to you.
Frank, let me go back to you, because one of the things I was talking with Robert Lustig about is whether or how the body differentiates between calories, whether it's a calorie from a sugar, a calorie from a piece of fruit, a calorie from a piece of chicken, for instance. From your perspective and from the work that you do, is a calorie a calorie a calorie?
That's a very interesting question. Question. Of course, a calorie is a calorie, of course, but the calories are metabolized differently depending on food sources. So the calorie in the whole fruit or the sugar in the whole fruit is metabolized very differently from the sugar in fruit juices or in sodas. And we published a study last year showing that people eating whole fruits on a regular basis had lower risk of developing type 2 diabetes. On the other hand, people who drink a relatively large amount of fruit juices, even though those were 100% fruit juices, had increased risk of developing type 2 diabetes. So people may say that what's the difference between the fructose in juices and the fructose in whole fruit. Clearly, the digestion absorption of fructose in whole fruit is very different from the fructose in juices. And that's the reason I think we have to distinguish different type of sugars and differentiate the different type of foods and the beverages. And some people have said that the fructose in whole fruits is a good fructose, whereas the fructose in fruit juices or in sodas is bad fructose. I think this is a very important concept for people to keep in mind.
You want to add to that, Robert Lustig?
No, I completely agree with Frank. I know that paper very well that he quoted. I wouldn't say that the fructose in fruit is good. What I would say is that the fructose in fruit doesn't have negative effects because the fiber mitigates those negative effects. In other words, you've packaged the poison with the antidote, and God did that to us, you know, or for us. When you consume fruit with its inherent fiber, the fiber takes care of the issue. I'll give you another example how this works. My colleague in the East Bay, Cindy Gershon, who is a chef and a food educator, and I wrote the cookbook with, she, on the first day of each one of her classes, takes two kids from this class, and she hands two of each of them six oranges. And she says to the first kid, "Here, kid, here's six oranges. Make juice." Kid squeezes the six oranges, gets 12.5 ounces of juice, downs the juice, and says, "Okay, what's for breakfast?" Says to the second kid, "Here, kid, here's six oranges. Eat the six oranges." Kid eats orange number one, number two. By the time the kid gets up to number three, he's looking a little queasy. He starts eating orange number four and throws up. Says, "I couldn't eat another bite. I'm going to die." So what happened? The fiber happened. The fiber reduced your ability to consume that orange, you know, all those oranges. In other words, when you consume foods with fiber, it's self-limiting. It induces satiety quicker. It fills up your stomach faster. Bottom line, low energy density, which people talk about, all of these things are good things in terms of mitigating obesity and chronic disease. So eat your fruit. Don't drink it.
Well, and to you, Frank, who, and then I do want to get back to our callers. We have a lot of people that want to talk to us. But if we reduced or even eliminated the added sugars in our diet in this country, would we be healthier?
Well, I think the problem right now is too much excessive consumption of added sugar. Recently, the WHO proposed a new target to reduce added sugar to 5% calories. And this is, I think, a good long-term goal. But in short term, I think it's very ambitious and very challenging for most people because most people consume way too much sugar, more than 15% calories from added sugar. So going down from 15% to 10% calories, I think is more realistic in short term. However, going down from 15% to 5%, I think it's going to be very challenging for most people. I don't think we are talking about eliminating added sugar from the diet. What we are talking about is to reduce the overconsumption of the sugar and improve the food environment and improve the food supplies. Added sugar is just one of the nutritional challenges in our food supplies. We consume too much salt, too much saturated fat, not enough fruits and vegetables, and whole grains. So when we talk about reducing added sugars, we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that we are eating a very poor diet in general.
Robert Lustig, your response, and then we'll get to Ken from Clementon, New Jersey.
I agree with everything Frank said. That's exactly right. The WHO based its 5% recommendation, which just came out last week, on dental caries. And dental caries are a bigger problem worldwide than we in America really, you know, deal with. And so, you know, the WHO is an international body, and they are doing their best because dental caries are the biggest source of pain in children, and they really do affect, you know, quality of life and health in ways here in America where we have dentists and fluoride and, you know, reasonably good, I won't say good, but reasonably good dental hygiene compared to the rest of the world. You know, 5% actually makes sense for the world. I agree with Frank, 5% is extraordinarily challenging. the American Heart Association document from 2009 basically wanted to bring it down to 8%. The point is right now we are at 15 to 16%. So we need to get that down by at least half. And the problem is that half of the sugar we're consuming is in foods we didn't know had it. Mm-hmm. And there are 56 names for sugar, so you're not allowed to know what you're consuming.
And let me get Ken from Clementon to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Ken, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good day. Good day. Thank you for the call.
You're welcome.
The call.
Sure.
I understand from articles I read years ago that sugar could be considered a drug, refined sugar. And the question is, if you had 50 people and you limited their diet to water, and you had another 50 people and you limited their diet to water and enough sugar to make it a diet drink or a drink, which group would pass away first? And I think it gives a whole new meaning to war on drugs. Thank you.
Ken, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Franco, let me take his a question. About, do you see sugar as a drug? Should we think of sugar as a drug?
I don't think so. I mean, I'm not sure whether the caller was talking about addictive property of sugar. I mean, certainly we are hardwired for a sweet taste, and we will like sweet foods, and some people may develop addictive behaviors for various sweet foods, and that may be a reason why it's so difficult to kick the sugar habits for most people, and that was the reason it's extremely important to change our food supplies in order to substantially reduce added sugar intake in the population.
And Robert Lustig, I mean, seems to me there'd be no way to run the experiment because people
eat more
than just, you know, water or sodas.
Right. That experiment, just doesn't hold water or sugar for that matter.
Right. Or sugar
I don't want to go there. The question is whether or not sugar should be regulated. Now, I'm going to be very honest with you. I think that we need to reduce our sugar consumption in this country, and the food industry won't let us. I think the government does have to get involved in this. One of the reasons that the food industry has been able to get away with this is because sugar is on the generally recognized as safe list. Now, this is also known as the GRAS list. This was set up in 1958, and there were 180 items on the list when it started in 1958. Today, there are 10,000 items on the list. And all the food industry has to do is place an item on it, and it's on it. The FDA does not have to sanction a food to be on that list for it to get on that list. The question is, the GRAS list was set up for conditions of intended use. And in 1958, we didn't intend to have a doubling of our sugar consumption over the 50 years since then. The problem is, we need to get back to where we used to be. And how are we going to do that when the food industry is basically shoving the sugar down our throats? The only thing I can see is some mechanism to basically get our sugar consumption down, and asking people to be mindful of this when they're basically not even told what the real story is based on what's on the food label and the fact that there are 56 names for sugar. You just can't expect people to be able to count this.
Let me get to one more caller on this. Is Sissy from Lankenau Hospital? Sissy, go ahead. You're on Radio Times. Do we have you, Sissy? No, we don't. She had a question about personal responsibility. I'll just read what it says on the computer. What about personal responsibility when consuming sugar, especially in the face of pressure from the food industry? What do we do? That's something you just touched on, but I'd be curious from you, Frank, who, how do we navigate these waters?
Well, I think it's very, very difficult for individuals to reduce their sugar consumption just by themselves, by behavior changes, because added sugar is so ubiquitous in our food supplies. If we don't change the food environment, the food supplies, I think it's very, very challenging for individuals to reduce their sugar consumption. And there are several policy initiatives have already been proposed and are being discussed and debated. I think many of those proposals can have major benefits in terms of changing the food supply and the food environment. So the soda tax, I think, can be very useful. If it's high enough, it can actually influence purchasing behavior. I think it's a good idea to put the warning labels on soda cans. That was just recently proposed by the California legislature. And right. This kind of warning labels can increase awareness about the harmful effects of soda on obesity, diabetes, and tooth decay. And it has worked very well in terms of reducing cigarette smoking. I think it can also work well for reducing soda. So I think, again, we need to combine the policy initiatives and awareness campaign and the individual behavior changes to actually make a major differences in terms of reducing sugar consumption.
And we're almost out of time. To you, Robert Lussick, since this is something that you're so passionate about.
I should give a TED Talk on this.
Be my guest. But no, I have a quick question for you. I mean, do you have some degree of optimism that we can address this issue?
3 years ago, I would have said no. And today, I would say absolutely yes. We have reached a tipping point. The fact is that the FDA now thinks that added sugar should be added to the food label. I'll tell you that the U.S. government has been the biggest logjam in terms of this, and the reason is because they're being pelted with, lobbying from the other side. For the FDA to have actually come out and said that we needed to put added sugars on the side of the food label means that there's been some, seismic shift in the way the FDA is operating. So I think that there is much more optimism and much more reason for hope today than 3 years ago.
Well, Robert Lussick, thank you for joining us once again on Radio Times.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And Frank Hu, thank you.
Thank you.
And Frank Hu, thank you very much for joining us as well.
Yeah, thank you.
You're welcome. And for more information about Radio Times and to continue this conversation, go to whyy.org/Radio Times. You can leave a comment. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and you can download a podcast. Adam Staniszewski, our engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Builder, and Emily Bryant. I'm Marty Moskowain. Thank you so much for joining us.